Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, it happens every Christmas week, every year. I think it's the busiest week of the year for movies.
I think so.
I mean, we've done more. We're only going to talk about six tonight. We've probably talked about seven or eight before. But these are heavy hitters. Like, these are major Hollywood blockbuster films. Out of the six, there are three huge directors. We're going to talk about Spielberg. We're going to talk about Ridley Scott. We're going to talk about Alexander Payne. Huge stuff, but yeah, I want you to...
I'm sorry, but some of the best stuff is actually by the lesser-known directors, as far as I'm concerned.
Ooh la la. Oh, I can't wait to find out what that is. So you actually provided the wine tonight. Do you remember?
That's a while back. That's from... Was that last week that I brought that?
Yeah, it was 2 weeks ago.
So...
But why did I pick it?
We had a reason... So it's the Ménage à Trois wine that I think I had brought to go with... when we had Christian here as a guest.
But we drank something else. We drank Dark Horse that night.
Yes.
Why did I pick this one tonight?
Why did you pick Ménage à Trois tonight? Let's see. I'm trying to think of the various movies. I don't know. Is it related to Greatest Showman somehow?
No, not at all. It's related to probably one of the worst movies we're going to talk about tonight, Pitch Perfect 3.
Oh, come on. Oh, Ménage à Trois. Well, okay. Well, here's what I brought, though, which is...
What is this going to be?
It's got a twist top should we need to refill the glasses.
Oh, it's a tiny little...
Yeah, so...
Cavit Merlot.
It's a small bottle.
Well, it's... Okay, I see what you did. When I first saw Italy, I thought you were gonna it was gonna be all the money in the world. But since you emphasized small, you're talking about Alexander Payne's downsizing.
That's right. And so it's a mini bottle of wine.
That's
so
funny.
Yeah, come on, it's cute.
So I think every year around Christmas time is the musical. The Annie remake, Les Mis, Into the Woods. There's a movie musical every Christmas.
No, they're not that often.
People think family, I guess maybe they do. Families go to the movies on at least once over Christmas because they get tired of looking at one another. All the gifts are unwrapped. Let's go to the movies and ignore each other for 2.5 hours. And this year, there's a big musical, The Greatest Showman, ya boy, Hugh Jackman. How is Hugh Jackman as P.T. Barnum?
I love Hugh Jackman. The guy is so freaking talented. He sings, he acts, he dances. He seems like a really nice guy. And so I can watch him in anything. And while I had my doubts in the first few minutes of this movie, when it opened up, I was like, story-wise, it was really kind of a little weak. But when they break out into song, you feel like you are watching a big Broadway musical production. And that is the best part of this movie, is I don't care really so much what happens between the numbers, but when that when they are going between big musical numbers, this is just a lot of fun to watch. It's like watching a big Broadway musical on screen.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. The songs are phenomenal. They stick in your head. I've been listening to them for the past 2 weeks now. Mm-hmm. They're really good. And unlike Les Mis, they're not sung live. You can't run and jump and trapeze like these guys are doing and sing quality songs. It's recorded music, but I you know, that's only for the purists who care about that stuff. But the songs are so much better than the story. The story is this biography, actually, this history. There was a P.T. Barnum in the early to mid-19th century who was this quirky genius who figured out, you know, how to make oddities profitable. And, yeah, the story, it moves so fast. It's choppy. And I was thankful. Oh, thank God we have another song coming around.
Yeah, no, for sure. But it almost doesn't matter. This is the kind of film where I could see it. I can see myself going back and seeing it again to appreciate the musical numbers more, because I was a little distracted when we did see it by the fact that my expectations, I think, were so low going into this, because we did not get a screener. We did not get to screen it before we had our Washington Area Film Critics Awards. And so my fear was that the studio was just trying to kind of just sort of push it out there a little bit under the rug. And then suddenly, I think because the music really is resonating with people and they're enjoying it, it's getting a lot of really good reviews, particularly from our Washington Critics group. But then other people, this, you know, if you don't like Broadway musicals, you will not like this movie. And so it's easy enough to say, hey, if you're just the type that doesn't like a musical, don't waste your time on this. But for fans of musicals, this is one where you will go back and you will go online, you will listen to the soundtrack, you will look for the two power ballads that just absolutely will stick with you.
The power ballad I was most taken by, and I think we actually split on this.
Yes.
I like This Is Me. It's sung by Keala Settle, who plays the bearded woman. And her whole, you can see her theme coming from a mile away. I'm proud of who I am now. I can now go out in public because I have this family. I belong to something. I'm going to be me. This is me. And today, Kesha, you know, she just released a cover version of that, and it stinks. leave Keala Settle alone. It's her song now. These songs are by the same gentleman who did the songs for La La Land. And yeah. The movie poster wants you to know that. From the guys who wrote the songs for La La Land. In fact, La La Land's almost bigger on the poster than The Greatest Showman. It's like, do you remember La La Land? It was a really good movie. For about 30 seconds, it won Best Picture. Remember La La Land? Well, then Greatest Showman. I am no movie musical aficionado. I was ho-hum about Les Mis. I hated Into the Woods. I loved Moulin Rouge.
Yes.
So, this one I really, really liked.
Yeah, I don't think it's as good as a Moulin Rouge or a Les Mis or a Dreamgirls, but it's still really just a fun time at the movies for somebody who likes a musical. My favorite song, I know that yours was the Bearded Lady song, but for me, the showstopper while watching this film was a ballad sung by the characters played by Rebecca Ferguson. And she is supposed to be this famous opera singer that catches the eye of P.T. Barnum, and he brings her to the U.S. to perform. And she does this song called Never Enough. And it's actually sung by a woman named Lauren Allred, who was a finalist on The Voice in 2012. And I had never heard of her. And now I'm listening and going, wow. I mean, first of all, it's an amazing dubbing job that is done, because you are just absolutely captivated by this number when it's being sung. And most everyone else does their own singing in this movie, but this is one that happens. Rebecca Ferguson does not sing this song. It takes some like major vocals, and that's my favorite. I wish I had a screener to be able to go back and just watch that scene again.
And there are other sub things in the movie. Zac Efron and Zendaya are in the movie, and their whole thing is an interracial romance, which did not happen in 1850. It's not just that it was, frowned upon or shunned. Like, violence would have happened. So you got that whole part. You got P.T. Barnum and his sainted wife, yeah, Charity, played by Michelle Williams. She gets her own musical number towards the end, which is forgettable. But she's like a put away, forgotten, suffering wife for a while, and she is the one who gave up everything for him. So she's got her own story arc going over there. And then he kind of turns his back on, I don't know what you want to call them, the oddities, the freaks, who trusted him, who said, you know what, we'll give you a chance because, we could get hurt doing this as well. And so there's a lot of juggling themes going on, and they somewhat almost all work only because of the songs.
Absolutely. And it's a spectacle. You are watching just a spectacle. And so it does work because of the songs. And again, I love Hugh Jackman. He can really do no wrong when you can think about the fact that this guy has been on Broadway himself. It can go from being Wolverine to Jean Valjean. I mean, it really is quite amazing.
I like Hugh Jackman better when he does Les Mis or The Greatest Showman than when he is Wolverine. I'm so tired of that character. Do something like even Logan, which is a deeper Wolverine movie. I'll take this Jackman.
But if you ever saw him, did you see him in The Prisoners, I think it was called?
Prisoners was great.
Yeah, and I mean, he took a major dark turn in that movie. And so I just think his versatility to me is just phenomenal.
And they took a chance on the director. First-time director, Michael Gracie. He does commercials and music videos. Mm-hmm. Hugh Jackman did a commercial with him, and he did. And they said, hey, we should work together sometime. Michael Gracie's like, yeah, sure, that's what they all say. And he got a call. He said, hey, come do this mega budget movie musical. And yeah, talk about taking a chance on a newbie.
Yeah, and this is the PG family fare option from what we've been able to review. We did both miss Jumanji.
The biggest film of the week will probably be Jumanji, because all the families with kids are going to go see that.
Yes, but this one, if you want to go and take the kids to see something with music in it, especially if your kids are into musical theater, this is the better choice for them.
Yeah, I think kids will like this just fine. Mm-hmm. All right, our next movie is Pitch Perfect 3.
Speaking of music.
a movie which does not need to exist. I saw the first Pitch Perfect, and I liked it. You know, it's not everyone thinks, oh, you saw Pitch Perfect, you must have hated it. No, I didn't. I really liked it. Anna Kendrick was awesome. Rebel Wilson as Fat Amy is phenomenal. Pitch Perfect 2, not as good, but good. Palatable. It was fine. It's, instead of competing at the college level, which they did in the first one, then they competed on the world level against Das Sound Machine, and that was funny. And they introduced Haley Steinfeld, and okay, that's fine. I'll follow the Barden Bellas. Pitch Perfect 3. Garbage. Absolute trash.
No.
What a stupid movie.
It doesn't have much reason for existing. That I can totally agree with you there. But it plays to its fan base, who will watch it anyway, who will enjoy it for the musical numbers and for Anna Kendrick and Rebel Wilson. I don't even remember the other girls who were in it.
Anna Camp. She's Haley Steinfeld's back.
Yeah, but no, right. But nobody, but they have nothing to do other than support the story.
Oh, nobody has anything to do.
Nobody has anything to do. And so the plot is beyond preposterous.
John Lithgow has an Australian accent. It's atrocious.
It's campy, but he's playing it very campy. And so you have to embrace the camp of this particular one. I don't think the first Pitch Perfect and Pitch Perfect 2, what made them probably way more palatable to you and to everyone is the fact that there really was story.
They took them almost seriously.
Yeah.
Hey, this is about glee clubs and a cappella, but we're going to tell you a story and make you care about characters.
Where this, even
this is a farce.
This is a farce. The premise is ridiculous that here the girls have all, gone on to, they've graduated from Barden and they need to go on to real lives and real jobs and it's not going so well. And suddenly they have this opportunity to reunite and perform on a USO tour overseas, only because one of the girls' fathers is like some military muckety-muck. And that's how they end up with this spot on the world tour with bands who actually play instruments and are very good.
And one of the funniest jokes in the movie is one of the names of the bands, Evermoist.
Yeah,
we are Evermoist.
Yeah, the whole, again, it's very campy. And the biggest disappointment to me is how Elizabeth Banks and John Michael Higgins.
Terrible.
They were so underutilized in this film. So they were always in the first two. They were just really great comic relief throughout in terms of playing these color commentators who follow the Barden Bellas. And so when this film starts out, you get this sense that you find out that they're doing a documentary, that these two are doing a documentary on the Bellas, and that's their sort of reason for kind of tracking them around the globe when they go overseas. But they are so wasted here. But the documentary premise, I think, could easily serve as the basis for what we know will come if this movie makes any money, which is Pitch Perfect 4, the comeback tour.
That's ridiculous. They took the best parts of the first two films and made them terrible. Remember, like, everyone always loved the riff-off. They do it again, and it's forced, and it feels awkward, and I hated watching them try to do it.
It's all contrived, but it's still entertaining for the pitches, for the fan base, the pitches that are going to watch this film.
My ultimate guilty pleasure are the Pitch Perfect taglines. Welcome back, pitches, and coming
Merry
is Pitchmas.
Pitchmas.
I think that's awesome. And, the Barden Bellas, they're doing with, they've all graduated. They're having their quarter-life crisis. Everyone's living miserable early mid-20s lives. So they come back together, blah, blah, blah. It's not, and they each sidle up to a different guy. You pair off with him, make that force, and it's like, oh, really? Is that what we're doing here?
It was all very contrived.
And Rebel Wilson's stupid story.
The John Lithgow character is like her con man father who just suddenly appears out of nowhere. and has some nefarious motives for wanting to reconnect with his daughter. But it's, and so, I mean, there's like an explosion scene that looks like they're trying to do a skit out of Charlie's Angels or something. And
oh, yeah, it's told in flashbacks so they can show the explosion twice.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that the law of diminishing returns is definitely at play with Pitch Perfect. So, you know, one was refreshing and original and great. Two is a serviceable sequel. Three is a very weak sequel, but there will be a four. And when that four happens, I hope they redeem themselves with a better
plot.
But
the poster says final call.
I know. It says
last call.
The farewell. It's like the farewell tour.
So no more.
No, no, no more. What comes after a farewell tour?
Hopefully 20 years of nothing and then 20 years from now.
A comeback tour. So you heard it here first. In 5 years, we're going to be here talking about the comeback tour.
And a Pitch Perfect 3 is easily one of the worst movies of the year.
I just think it's weak. It falls into that weak category. But I do think that a lot of the teenagers and the people who really enjoy that entire franchise, they're still going to come out for this one. But it's not going to capture new fans, that's for sure.
It's no secret in Hollywood that garbage still makes money. But now for something completely different. Steven Spielberg is talking about 1971, but it's current. It feels like current events. We're talking mm-hmm. about The Post. And when I say The Post, I mean The Washington Post, which published its share after the New York Times of the Pentagon Papers in 1971. Robert McNamara, Lyndon Johnson, all of them knew we could not win the Vietnam War way back in 1965. Yet they continued to send boys over there to get slaughtered because they wanted to save face, maybe eke out a tie. And when that bombshell landed on the American psyche in the early 70s, it was huge. People, you know, back then trusted the government, trusted the military. They're telling us the truth. And it turns out, oh my God, they were lying to us all along. And this is about the newspaper men who broke that story.
And
who
woman.
Fought whether or not to publish that story. Mm-hmm. But that is half of The Post. The other half is also just as timely, if not more timely, about Katharine Graham, played by Meryl Streep. What is going on with Katharine Graham?
Well, this is sort of the first movie in that journalism juggernaut universe to give Katharine Graham her due for her role in the making that decision to publish some of these Pentagon Papers, and at great risk personally and professionally. So here it tells her story where she had taken over the paper from her husband who had committed suicide, and she was kind of started out relatively meek, and her underlings kind of counted on that. But then you had this this huge story break, and they needed her to really step up and help them take a stand. And she does, but she was very inside Washington, so it was difficult. She was really good friends with Bob McNamara. And, you know, for her to have to kind of try and figure out whether it's worth potentially losing the paper and going to jail in order to publish a story, it's an interesting aspect to the story that was missing from, like, in All the President's Men.
You know, and you've had the standard newspaper scenes, like, stop the presses, and everyone running around and on the phone and hectic. But The Post is very preachy. You know, they're telling you up way too overt sometimes. Mm-hmm. This is why newspapers are good for you and good for the country. There's quotes like, the press is to serve the governed, not the governors.
Well, because it was important. This one was rushed to completion.
It went very fast.
Because of what was happening with the government threatening to undermine First Amendment rights and freedom of the press. And so that's why it was very important to Steven Spielberg and his entire team to get this film out earlier rather than later. I read this morning, I mean, the screenwriter for this, her name's Liz Hanna, of all things, and she was like 31 when she wrote this. She wrote it Labor Day of 2016,
man,
her first draft.
So fast.
She finished her first draft, and for it to have gotten into the hands of Steven Spielberg, it then was, the screenplay was sort of polished by the screenwriter for Spotlight to give it a little bit of the Spotlight treatment. And she to have gotten her script this far with Spielberg, Hanks, and Meryl Streep. That's just phenomenal. And I think it might have been a little too rushed because to me, I did not love this movie as much as, you know, like a Spotlight or an All the President's Men. To me, those were still much better journalism movies with a lot more drama. And this one, does anyone really expect Spielberg, Hanks, and Streep to deliver anything other than just a really solid movie with really good performances? No, they deliver that. But to me, it's not a Best Picture kind of film.
I was supposed to love this movie. And I was surprised when I walked out and I really liked this movie. I didn't love it. Spotlight was actually much, it socked you in the gut a little bit more than The Post.
Absolutely.
And I think with another year under development, The Post would have landed that punch. But it did need to come out now, even though it is preachy. I say preach on, brother.
Yeah.
Because you've got people saying alternative facts are a thing now and fake news and undermining the credibility of the freedom of the press and the manipulation. Just, it's, you know, they have Nixon in a couple scenes here. You only see his back in the White House just railing. And these are real transcripts because he recorded everything, just railing about the press and then the revenge he was going to get on all of these people. It needed to come out now. So, okay, thank you for rushing it, but you shot yourself in the foot a little bit because you did it.
I agree. It is a homage to great journalism and the people that make it happen. So I applaud that as a journalism major. But I do feel like it suffered a bit and that it's going to do much better in Washington than it might do out in the Midwest, you know, out in the middle of the country.
Oh, this is only going to be seen in the metropolitan areas.
Yeah.
Any city that has a large newspaper base.
Yeah, but I'd be really disappointed to see, like, Meryl Streep take the Best Actress nomination away from somebody else that really would deserve it.
She'll probably get nominated again. Maybe Tom Hanks will as well. And he's very good as Ben Bradley,
They're all good, but they're better than the movie as a whole.
It's a strong ensemble.
It is a strong ensemble, but yeah, it is not in All the President's Men.
No, it's not. Next up, All the Money in the World. Ridley Scott, Mr. Alien franchise himself. It doesn't matter anymore what it's about and whether it's good, because it's been overshadowed by something that happened. All the Money in the World is about J. Paul Getty. I think I might have heard the name once before in my life. I did not know who this guy was. I've heard of Rockefeller. I've heard of Carnegie. I've never really heard of Getty, and I wonder if that is because of Getty the Man, which we'll get to. But it doesn't matter anymore, because Kevin Spacey was J. Paul Getty, and a month, 2 months before this thing was supposed to hit theaters, they went in and digitally erased Kevin Spacey.
I don't think they did that. I was reading it was more they went and they reshot almost all those scenes.
Christopher Plummer exploded on Twitter. # Christopher Plummer, come and save this too, if you will. 88-year-old Christopher Plummer came in and within a day and then a couple weeks later was done and they had to re-edit the whole thing. And I honestly wonder how much his entire research, they had to bring back Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams and the whole thing and get back to Italy, or maybe they didn't.
They went and reshot a lot of it.
The behind the scenes on this probably could make its own documentary. Mm-hmm. I hope someone was taking footage of this. But that is what is going to overshadow. There is a movie in here, and it's about a kidnapping. It's about the early 70s. Do you remember? Did you know about J. Paul Getty and J. Paul Getty III?
Well, I mean, this kidnapping occurred in 1973, so I was still young. Alive, but young. And so I don't really remember hearing about this kidnapping. And the fact that it happened in Rome and we didn't have a CNN or, you know, 24/7 news back then. So chances are it didn't make as big a splash as it might have today. But I know of Getty because I lived in L.A., and so anybody who lives in L.A. knows very well the Getty, the villa up on the hill in Malibu that was a home of his, that was the original housing museum of all of his art, and now there's the humongous, beautiful Getty Museum that basically was very close to all those wildfires that were going on, but had some amazing fire protection to keep all of that art safe in California. And so I knew the name mostly from the affiliation with the art museum in LA. So did I really know how he made his money other than knowing that there was oil involved? Not really. So this movie to me, I think, is going to be somewhat divisive, because if you read about, like, some people love it and I did not, and it got 3 Golden Globe nominations. And I'm like, how did they even see this movie in time to give it these Golden Globe nominations? I just think that that was a gift for just the feat of having gotten it out the door on its promised date when they had to reshoot so much stuff because Kevin Spacey got creepy on him at the end there. And so it's just kind of sad, because I was distracted through most of this film watching Christopher Plummer, who's excellent, but I really now want to see the original. I want to see what it looked like with Kevin Spacey in that role, because I could see him being a very different John Paul Getty, and I'm curious what that would look like.
I hope it becomes this cult underground thing where someone somehow got a print of Spacey as Getty, because I would watch it too. I bet he did something really different with it. And he probably had a year to chew on this role before he decided how he was going to do it. And he's 30 years younger than Christopher Plummer. Sure, he was probably under heavy prosthetics and makeup, but I still want to see it.
I do too.
And the name Getty must have really meant something in the 70s. I mean, just, he was, they said he at that point was the richest man who had ever lived. I mean, more than Roman emperors, and he thought he was a Roman emperor reincarnated. This guy was malicious. He was evil. Yes. He was a mean dude and cheap. The richest guy who ever lived was the cheapest man who ever lived. But good on you, Ridley Scott. Rome, I was not in Rome in the early 1970s, but I think this is probably what it looked like. And it reminds me of a lot of La Dolce Vita. You had all those paparazzi on the little mopeds scooting around there. It looked really familiar. But man, that guy is evil. And it's a kidnapping story. So half of it takes place in like a little cell between the scared boy and his captors, and a nice captor versus evil captors and investors who end up buying him, and people trying, his mom, Michelle Williams, going catatonic, and Mark Wahlberg, probably the worst. I don't know if his role is underwritten, poorly written, or if he didn't do a very good job.
I didn't think it was that he didn't do a good job. I just thought his character had, there was no character development there. It's like, you're supposed to just kind of figure out that he was like some CIA operative, and he had some training, and he was one of Getty's advisors, and so Getty just basically sent him to, you know, go try and figure out what's really going on with the grandson's kidnapping, because he's not going to pay for any ransom. And maybe if he does pay anything, it's got to be negotiated, because everything has to be a negotiation. And even though he's got, quote unquote, all the money in the world, he is not willing to spend what would have been to him probably a drop in the bucket to get his 16-year-old grandson released. And this movie, though, takes really like a dark turn with some torture kind of stuff. And so I just did not enjoy it. And that was, to me, the biggest problem. Michelle Williams, she's in 2 movies this week. So it shows her versatility, too, that she goes from the saintly wife in The Greatest Showman to here, where she is a very strong female character also
she's a neglected wife. She's still playing the wife.
Yeah, she's divorced from Getty's drug and alcohol addicted son, and that family dynamic is really what is a big part of the plot here. But I just, in the end, I did not enjoy this movie, and so I just found it, you know, just kind of flat. So I just think that the biggest thing that this movie has going for it is the curiosity factor regarding Christopher Plummer.
No, I'm with you. This movie is sour. I did not enjoy watching it. It also seems very dark. The lens was tinted. It's like, wow, I wasn't alive in 73, but was it this dark in 73? It kind of washed out. And man, that Mark Wahlberg thing's just terrible. But a much better movie, one which I really enjoy, which I didn't think I was going to enjoy because I didn't even want to go to it. I do not like movies about things I already know, so I did not want to go see I, Tonya. I remember Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding, so why do I need to see? It's like going to see movies about O.J. Simpson. I don't want to, but I, Tonya is phenomenal, and do you know why? How do I know it's so good? Because I was rooting for Tonya Harding. I was empathizing with her. I felt bad for her. It's like, Tonya, how did you make it as far as you did with that mother and that husband? I, Tonya, is powerful.
I mean, I, Tanya, but it's quirky. It's a weird movie. And so people, this is no Ice Castles or Cutting Edge. You know, you're not, if you go, oh, I like ice skating movies, that's not this. This plays like a mockumentary. It opens.
They're on the couch like they are in The Office or Modern Family.
And it's based on transcripts from the FBI and police investigations. And so it's the truth as far as anyone can guess it might be based on Tanya Harding and Jeff Galluli, her ex-husband's transcripts. So do we know whether this is still really, how much of this is a bit of a letting Tanya a little more off the hook than she might otherwise deserve? It's hard to know, but you definitely feel some empathy for her. Allison Janney just nails it as her mother, which it's sort of like the equivalent of a evil stage mom, I guess.
Everyone's best supporting actress this year is Laurie Metcalf in Lady Bird. And not since I saw Allison Janney as LaVonna Harding. Oh my lord, this woman blows, like in the first scene, knocks your socks off. She is so foul-mouthed and evil to her daughter. Bravo, Allison Janney.
It's a great, she embraces that role. She is great in it. And I think that it's a tie. Like, to me, Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird and Allison Janney and I, Tanya, are both up there for potential Best Supporting Actress nominations. I mean, this is a great role for her. But, I mean, talk about great Margot Robbie as Tanya Harding.
Miss Australia herself with the Portland, Oregon kind of lower, low middle class
playing basic
accent.
White trash and, you know, having to kind of go the white trash route. She's phenomenal.
She's very good.
It's amazing that she embodies. I remember the story very well. I mean, 94, I was covering a lot of this story. And I'd forgotten things like the fact that way before there was a TMZ, there was a hard copy. And they do the greatest sort of take on the hard copy producer and what was going on with that part of the story. And Margot Robbie absolutely captures the look and the sound, the wardrobe, the hairstyle, everything that you will remember from seeing Tanya Harding back in the mid-90s during all of this. And she took, Margot Robbie took Tanya Harding to the premiere, the red carpet premiere of this movie. And I think some people will get nominated just so that Margot Robbie will bring Tanya Harding
to
the Oscars.
I would love to see Tanya Harding Oscars.
I think we will, because what better red carpet moment than to have Tanya
bring
Harding
the house
out
down
there.
Now, Margot, one of them, spends the whole movie saying, it wasn't fair. It's not my fault. And, you know, the movie doesn't let Tanya Harding off the hook. She was in the room when she could hear the planning. She didn't actively take part in it. She was probably horrified, it seems, when it happened. But she seems like she paints herself as such the victim when she's really not. She had something to do with it. But it's so well made that in the end, it's almost like, in a way, she had to work so hard and everything came so easily to Kerrigan that in the end, Tanya Harding is technically America's sweetheart. While Nancy Kerrigan is just, because Tanya Harding was the better skater. She could do the triple axel.
Technically.
Nancy Kerrigan wouldn't even attempt it. Tanya Harding is one of only six women in the history of the world to land the most difficult jump in women's figure skating, the triple axel. And she did it. And the judges would not fairly rate her because she was not a Disney princess.
No, because there is technical merit and artistic merit. And she did not play the game.
They were judging her for off the ice issues.
They were judging her for not having the artistic side that Nancy Kerrigan did have.
And Nancy Kerrigan was
Oksana
rich
Baiul
and privileged and had her own training ice.
But she was more attractive on the ice. She was a smoother skater. Tanya Harding was by far the technically superior skater. And there was no way. They couldn't even find. They had to use CGI to
they couldn't do it.
To do the triple axel that you see Tanya Harding perform in this movie, because there's only one other woman in the world right now who I think can actually do one. And so, and I think she might even be Asian, so they couldn't necessarily use her to double. But so they had to actually just use computer generated graphics in order to land that triple axel. So that does show you just how incredibly difficult it was. And it is sad. I mean, you feel bad for the fact that her life imploded because she surrounded herself by these idiots.
Oh, let me get on the idiot here. And it's not even just Jeff Galooly. Sebastian Stan is Jeff Galooly. The idiot,
the bodyguard,
is Sean Eckert. Now, he's played so well by Paul, I think his name is Paul Hauser. And Sean Eckert, he spends all the time, I'm an expert in counterintelligence and I know men and da 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 da. What a moron. And you're aghast. You're agape with, this is how it happened. These idiots were able to actually bang someone on the knee. And I can't believe how stupid.
He was hysterically inept. And I loved how at the end of this film, they actually play some of the real footage from that time when the bodyguard was being interviewed. Sean Eckhart was being interviewed about things. And you realize, just looking through the lens of knowing now what we do, that it's just really funny and sad and bizarre. And it is a bizarre time in the history. What's most fascinating is that it's called I, Tanya. This is not I, Tanya, and I, Nancy.
Nancy's not even in it.
She's just sort of like in the shadows getting whacked in the knee for about 2 seconds and screaming and whining, why me, which everyone remembers. But this does not have any input from Nancy Kerrigan's camp at all. And it is strictly a redemption movie of sorts for Tanya Harding. And she is making the most of it right now.
I don't know, but she's not very redemptive. Like, it's still, she done did bad things and surrounded herself with morons. But look at everything she had to do just to get on the same playing field as Nancy, who didn't have to do anything.
Yeah, but when you realize the
hence
punishment,
all my empathy.
The punishment for her versus the punishment, skating was everything to her.
Yeah.
And to be banned for life from the U.S. figure skating team is, was everything. And, and then she had to sort of find her way with, like, the celebrity boxing matches and the, now I think she's a landscaper. So she definitely built a different new life for herself. But you do kind of wonder sometimes, like, whether or not, technically speaking, from a skating perspective, what she might have been able to accomplish.
It's just sad. It really is.
Yeah.
And it is a phenomenal movie. I really got a lot out of this.
It's good, but it's going to be an acquired taste for some because it is a very different, oddball way of telling this story.
All right. Our final film of the podcast is Downsizing. And this might be the most divisive film in reality of people, because there are people who 4 stars love Downsizing. National Board of Review said it was one of the 10 best films of the year. Ann Hornaday in Today's Post gave it 4 stars. Then there are people who hate Downsizing, and I do not love it, and I do not hate it, but I'm not down the middle either. I like it / almost really like it, because it's a tale of two halves. The first hour is one of the best films of the year. Matt Damon, Kristen Wiig are a married couple, and they're going to embrace the world's new technology. They're going to go from their 5.5-6 feet tall to 5 inches tall. They're downsizing, and it's, I don't know, save the environment, be rich, what have you. And then there's the second half, which turns, might have one of the, also the best supporting actresses of the year in it, in Hong Chow, but it turns into, I don't know, environmentalism, cynicism. Christoph Waltz is around. Did you pick up the two halves bit?
I did, and I did not like the second half at all. It turned into this very heavy-handed social satire, and this is not Honey, I Shrunk the Kids for adults that some people might think they're going to get from watching the trailer. This, and the fact that Kristen Wiig gets this double, is billed up there with Matt Damon as co-starring in this film. She freaking disappears from this movie.
Not going to tell you why.
I'm not going to tell you why, but I'm like, she's not a co-star of this movie. I was getting into that dynamic with Kristen Wiig and looking forward to seeing more of that part of the story. I did not like the second half. You talk about the divisiveness. Artie Chick, Jill, who I work with on Chick Flicks, she really loved this movie. She's one of these very social, conscientious you know, environmental minded folks, and she thought she loved this movie. And I fall where you say you kind of are on that divide where you liked it and almost like it a lot. I liked it, but almost didn't like it. And so I love Matt Damon usually. He's still the everyman in this film, as he is in most of his movies. But I just thought this film just, I don't know, it just took that turn in the middle that absolutely lost me and was not entertaining at all and was too preachy. And I love, talk about your big name directors. I mean, Alexander Payne.
You loved him. I loved, from Nebraska. He's your boy.
I loved him from The Descendants with George Clooney.
I did not like him.
No, but see, that was the one that, to me, put Alexander Payne really in that.
No.
In that sphere of.
That would be Sideways.
No, Sideways. But in terms of, but The Descendants is the one that I thought Alexander Payne spoke to really the mainstream audience in addition to the arty audience. And he was able to totally bridge that divide. He did it with Sideways to a great degree as well. Nebraska to a slightly lesser degree, but that was also a very good movie. So I expected so much more. And so to me, this movie represents my biggest disappointment of the Christmas movie season, of all the things that came out, because I so wanted to like it. I so expected to like it. And I just didn't. And I just found it just way too preachy. And I just didn't like where it went.
Alexander Payne and Matt Damon took a risk here. And it starts out, original strange. Like, ooh, this is quirky. I haven't really seen this mm-hmm. before. And most movies would stick with that. Quirky, quirky, strange throughout the whole thing. This starts quirky, strange, and it gets extra strange, like double, triple strange.
Yeah.
And that's a risk, and they probably knew what they were doing. There's a definite, like right at the midpoint, there's a dividing line where it switches, and Christoph Waltz comes in as this, he's a German, but he's playing a Serb. And Hong Chau, I have no idea who that was.
Yeah, yeah.
And she delivers such a powerhouse performance. She's really good.
I mean, she's good. She plays sort of this, she was like a political prisoner in Vietnam who ends up in the same working as a housekeeper for the Christopher Waltz character. And she's got a prosthetic leg. And the Matt Damon character, Paul Safronek, wants to.
Safronek.
I think that's a theme throughout the movie, too, is mispronouncing his name. But I think, you know, so he wants to help this woman. And he had seen her story on the news. And so he just decides that he wants to do something, make a difference with this new life where he's tiny. And you don't really get the sense. It's not like you're watching tiny people. It's shot in such a way that once they've established what's going on, it's all to scale. So you're seeing everything and everybody at that point, except when the people from the outside world are shown. They all look pretty, you know.
And that's what I thought downsizing was going to be about. I thought it was going to be about big versus little. And do you get the same rights as I do as little? Do you get the same one vote, one little person? You don't participate in my economy anymore. You can't consume. And so that's what I thought it was going to be about.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's actually about the environment.
Yeah. No, it is. And the idea, the whole purpose for people initially getting drawn to living in this little world was that you could live large with very little money, and as a tiny person, because your footprint on the
it's
earth
minuscule, yeah.
is minuscule, and so you could have a lot more. You know, it would be a great way to help with population control and all that stuff. So. I just think it. I think it lost its way in trying to be so. Again, it's satire and social commentary, and it starts off where you think it's going to be funny, but it's not a funny movie at all, and it's certainly not funny in the second half. There are some funny bits, and there's some, like you said, quirky. It's more quirky bits than funny. And it is satirical and cynical, and I just didn't enjoy it, and that to me was hugely disappointing.
All right, well, that is the Cinema Clash's annual. Good Lord, there are a lot of movies every year the week of Christmas. quick recap of them. We start off with The Big Bang, the musical, and I don't know if this is going to, you know, make $1 billion or $1 million, but Hugh Jackman is P.T. Barnum. Those songs are great.
Yeah, I think it's one of those ones that will do well in second and third and fourth runs. People are going to rent it and watch it. So I'm not sure it'll do so hot right now, except word of mouth, I think, is very good. We'll see if that helps it. But again, musical fans, this is the one to see, and I would not be surprised to see this actually make it to Broadway. I saw a show called Barnum on Broadway in like 1980, and so I suspect this one might come back, and you'll see Greatest Showman on Broadway.
Pitch Perfect 3 should have never existed. It's one of the worst movies of the year. Forget about it.
It's not terrible, but it had no reason to exist, and I think Pitch Perfect 4 will hopefully be better.
The Post, Steven Spielberg. It's a takes place in 1971, but it's really about 2017. Hooray for newspapers.
It's the most timely to see right now with the message that everybody should be getting. And yes, hooray for newspapers and journalism. And, you know, remember that democracy dies in darkness.
All the money in the world. You're only going to hear about Christopher Plummer replacing Kevin Spacey, but there actually is a sour, forgettable movie underneath.
There is, and I really can't wait to someday when all the dust settles about Kevin Spacey, even if he's in jail. I'd still like to see the first cut of this film.
I, Tanya, we're talking Margot Robbie, mostly we're talking Allison Janney, and how Tanya Harding never had a fair shake. I didn't like Tanya Harding growing up. I was Team Nancy. Call me Team Tanya, dyed in the wool, blue and through now. Go Tanya Harding.
I'm still a little torn, but I do think this film humanizes Tanya Harding, definitely. I give it a 5.7 on both artistic and technical merit.
See, you're just taught. You see, you're letting Jeff Galooly and what you hear, the rumors about Tanya off the ice, affect your score. She skated better than Nancy. Downsizing, I liked it better than you did. I don't mind that it went double strange from quirky, and man, it's out there.
It's out there. I say Downsizing would be at the very, very bottom of my list right now.
No.
Pitch
Perfect 3 is better than Downsizing?
For the Pitch Perfect...
You have done lost
your
mind.
There is a following...
It's not about the following. It's about what is the better movie.
No, because if you sent some of those Pitch Perfect following... The Pitch Perfect fan base to go see Downsizing...
They might have their eyes open and be like, oh my gosh, look.
They're going to come after you.
Yeah, because they might actually have to think and use a brain cell.
They are going to come after you with pitchforks.
They should be going after Rebel Wilson for playing that such a stupid role.
Yeah, this is what the beauty of the song is that there's truly, in this week of massive amounts of things, there is something for everyone. So if you think about what you're in the mood for and what kind of film you like, you're probably going to find your fit here, because there's the family films, there's the weird social satire, there's the quirky biopic. I mean, there's really something for just about anyone, even if we don't particularly like a film.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
We'll see you soon. Bye.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.